Let's do our last lecture. We're going to go through contracting methods and alternate project delivery methods. We're like design build and different types of philosophies and stuff for that. So, as we scroll through, we've talked about the AIA documents. Well, I've talked about it. You guys have asked questions about it throughout the most of the semester. And so what I wanted to do is and I keep talking about, like I think I've mentioned, it's a suite of documents, there's a collection of them. So I have this first slide that talks about how they're kind of organized. So when you get out there, and the AIA form will be used, as I said, probably in 75% of the contracts you ever negotiate or deal with or whatever. And so this is something you're going to see over and over and over, so it helps to get familiar with it. They have the A series, and the A series all deals with the contractor, owner-contractor side. And there's a whole bunch of different types of A series. Now, we went through the A201. That's the 200 series, and there's like the 233. There's a whole bunch of different 200 numbers. There's also a bunch of 100 numbers. And if you want to think about it, is the 100 numbers, and I'll have a slide come up in a little bit, but it's like the business terms, and the, you know, the how much it costs, what's the schedule, what's the date, who the people are. And the 200 series is like the rules to play Monopoly. It's the rules for the road, and they call that the general supplementary conditions. And so, and the A201 rolls into all these 100 series forms. There's one exception, it's called the A104, and what it does is it smashes the A201 into a smaller form and smashes the A101 and A102 and A103 all into one form. So it's like this tiny little compact one. And so you may use that for like some an addition to a project or somebody, like anything less than $1 million, you can use the A104. But if it gets complex, then you want to use the bigger documents. So the B series, we went through the B101, and there's a whole bunch of B documents, and we'll go through those in a second. That's the owner architect. I don't understand this because I didn't put this together over 120 years ago, but one would think that owner architect should be the A series. And owner contractor could be whatever it was, but it's not. So owner contractor is A, owner architect, even though it's an A, is the B series. And then the C series are all the subcontracts and consultants agreements. And so the parlance in the construction industry is contractors have subcontractors, and they do electrical and mechanical and carpentry and all this other stuff. Architects have consultants, or sometimes called subconsultants. You rarely refer to an architect when they hire an engineer to do the lighting systems or what have you. You rarely refer to that as a subcontractor. You refer to that as a consultant or a subconsultant. It's just a name thing. It doesn't mean anything legally, as long as the document, as we've talked about, has a capital S or a capital C or whatever it is for the defined term. But that's just your normal parlance. This is in the C series. Contractors are subcontractors. Designers are consultants. So, and then the G series is the financial documents. So it's like the invoice form. Now, a lot of companies that you'll work for will have their own invoice form, and they won't use the G series. And on the architect side, even much more so. But the G series, and the one that I have, I guess I don't have it listed here. The one you're going to see most commonly is called the G702 and the G703. That's what's called an application for payment. If you remember when we were looking through the A201 in Article 9, it talks about how you submit for payment, and it's called an application for payment as a capitalized term. That's what the G702 is and the 703, and it's got all the lines to list all your subcontractors, and it's all set up. It's a great form because the information that you need, whether it's going to be in a lump sum project, it's a cost plus agreement or a guaranteed maximum price agreement, whatever form agreement you're going to be using, a form of payment, not form agreement, form of payment, because those are three different forms of payment, that G702 and G703 lend yourself to that. So you don't have to have, if you're going to use a lump sum contract, you can still use the 702 and 703. If you're going to use the cost plus, use the same document. You don't have to have a mix and match of all that. Now, if you ever, in your career, when you get out there, go onto the AIA website, if you ever want to look at it, and click on the documents, there's probably 40 or 50 200 series documents, or A series documents. There's probably 25 B series documents. There's a whole bunch of them that have their own little subsets and everything else. So, like, if you're doing a construction management agreement. So instead of your traditional owner contractor, general contractor, the construction manager is when they come on earlier. We'll talk about that when we do alternative project methods in a second here. But that's going to be on the A133 and the A233, as opposed to the A101 and the A201. But they're all different forms. So this is the suite of documents. And the good thing about them, the reason why you'll see them for 75% of your projects is everybody's used them. They all have common terms. They're all interrelated. If you want to bring on a different party, you just pull a C-series document out. You pull that. So it's really well put together. There are, as I said earlier, there are other types of forms. There's called the consensus doc. Those are for the owner. That's the contractor size. So the contractor of their organization, like the AIA, puts together their contract documents. And then there's the EJCDC, which is the engineering side. They have their forms. The DBIA, Design Build Institute of America, they have their forms. You will see those from time to time, but I can say, in my 30-plus years of negotiating contracts, I think I've negotiated 5 DBIAs, maybe a dozen and a half contractor agreements, and maybe 2 EJCDC. So that just shows you of the form documents. It's really cited to the AIA. So it's kind of just as an overview. There won't be any questions about which documents you use the most and everything else. I just want to give you like this collection. So here's the forms on the A101. So this is on the contractor side. So the 101 is a standard form agreement based on a stipulated sum or lump sum. So that's when I come into you and I use the example, I'm going to build you this house for $1 million. We're going to do it for $1 million. That's a lump sum, a stipulated sum. You're locked into that, and unless there's change orders, meaning you add a bathroom or you find that the soil's bad or whatever the changes from what we all thought the project was in the beginning, contractor's going to build it for $1 million. That's a lump sum. The A102 is a form of agreement based on the cost of the work plus a fee with a guaranteed maximum price. I'm going to skip an explanation of that for a second and jump down to A103 because they're very similar. Once you learn what an A103 is, then I can explain how the 102 works. The 103 is a cost of the work plus a fee without a guaranteed maximum price. So basically, the A103 is pay as you go. Whatever the contractor spends on materials, the owner pays that plus the fee, which is the contractor's markup. And that can be anywhere between 1% and 30%, depending on what the project is, what the contractor is. You're going to find most contractors on a big project are going to come in between 5 and 10%. That's your traditional fees are going to come in that. So, and the same thing for the labor, whatever the contractor pays for the labor, that goes across plus the general contractor's fee on top of that. It is a transparent process from the A103. When I, as the general contractor, submit my invoice to the owner, I have to have backup of all the documents from my subcontractor, because if I say I spent $150,000 on foundations and concrete, I want to show my owner, here's the money I spent on the yards of concrete, the wood for the material, the rebar that went into the foundation, and the labor for pouring it. So there'll be 4 separate backup invoices for that one line item. So it's very document intensive, which is sometimes the contractors don't like. But if you have it without the guaranteed maximum price, which is a cap, it's an open-ended project. So doesn't matter whether it costs you, if you think you're going to give a budget or an estimate, as the contractor gives an estimate or a budget for the $1 million project, if it comes in at $2 million, contractor gets $2 million. If it comes in at $800,000, contractor gets $800,000. So owners, and my recommendation as a lawyer to my clients, if you're working with an owner, and if you as the architect will be working with the owner, I rarely recommend the cost plus without the guaranteed maximum price because it's open-ended. You just can't, whatever it costs is what it costs. Now, there are some projects that almost always fall into this category. Those would be something like if you're doing a renovation or a rehab of a building, nobody can see with X-ray vision behind the walls. So contractors are less likely to say, I can guarantee you this price or it's going to be a lump sum. They're going to say we're doing this at the cost of the work plus a fee. So that's what you're going to traditionally see in that, where it's the unknowns or where that kind of is driven. There are times where an owner may want to have, on smaller projects, may just say, you know, if you're going to give me a lump sum, because with a lump sum, they don't have to show you any of the bills. All they do is give you the one piece of paper that says, you owe me $200,000 for this month. None of the backup has to be shown to the owner in a lump sum. So if the contractor is overcharging or putting a little bit more extra money into their pocket, it doesn't matter, because that's the way the contractor bid it. You know, that $1 million bid, he may say, I know I can build it for $600,000. So owners like to see the transparency, but the owners get concerned with the 103 because it's open-ended. Contractors like the open-ended. They get cranky about the paperwork, but if they can get the open-ended, it's really good for them. So what do you do? Well, that's the 102. That's the middle road. And the 102 is the document that I probably negotiate the most. And the 102 takes the form of the 103, where it's the actual cost of the work, materials and labor, plus the contractor's fee. But the contractor in the very beginning says, I'm going to give you a guaranteed maximum price. So let's take this $1 million house as an example. Contractor comes in and he says, you know what? For maybe a lump sum, I'd tell you $1 million, but I'm going to tell you we're going to do a GMP, guaranteed maximum price. And the contractor, he or she, want to hedge their bets a little bit. So they may say $1.5 million. They may say, $1,100,000, $1,200,000. They may add some extra dollars in there for the cap, and that's the cap. But because it's based on the cost of the work, if the project comes in at $850,000, the owner pays only $850,000. But if the project comes, let's say it was $1.1 million, it was the GMP price that he gave to the owner as opposed to a $1 million lump sum. If the project comes in at $1.2 million, the owner pays only $1.1 million. So that cap sits there as the top that the owner will ever pay. Contractor takes the risk on the top side. Owner gets the benefit on the bottom side. And so you're like, well, why would a contractor enter into a contract where they're taking the risk and the owner's getting the benefit? Well, the other thing that happens often with a GMP agreement, guaranteed maximum price agreement, is the owner will negotiate a savings clause. Now, it's not in the form of the AAA document, but it's something that you will talk about with your clients. And so I say to the general contractor, I want to see transparency, but I don't want an open-ended deal. The contractor, she comes back and she says, okay, let's do a GMP. Okay, how much is it? $1.1 million. Great. We end up coming in at $900,000. There's a $200,000 gap between what the GMP was and what the owner's paying. So the owner's got $900,000 out of the pocket to incentivize the contractor to keep the price under that cap. You say, and for every dollar that you are under that $1.1 million, I will give you 25% of that. You don't have to work at all. So we take that $200,000 and there's $50,000 into the pocket of the contractor as pure profit. So the contractors are incentivized to get below the GMP. It makes a good relationship between contractor and owner because owner's seeing everything transparently. But the contractor has a benefit, like the owner does, of beating that cap. And then you say, okay, well, why wouldn't then a general contractor for that $1 million project, why wouldn't the general contractor come in at $1.4 million and say, hey, look at this big, huge cap, and he's going to automatically make a benefit and a profit on that? And sometimes they do that. So what does the owner do? The owner visits to 3 or 4 general contractors to make sure that that GMP is reasonable and fair. So there are checks and balances to the system. But I will say on projects, I will say for my clients, any project over $5 million, I always say you have to do a GMP, like unless it's a very rare circumstance. I will do GMPs on $1 million projects. I will do GMPs on $500,000 project. When you get down smaller than that, it may not be worth all the paperwork because it's all the documents, and if it's $500,000 or less, just do lump sum. But that's the, kind of the rule of thumb that I, when I talk to my clients about that. So the one area where you'll find, at least I have found in my career, where the owner has very little negotiating power in which form they get, is like I said, one of the examples is when you do renovation, you know, like you're rehabbing an old building. because you don't know what to see behind the walls. The other area is in ultra-high residential projects. These contractors, there's not a lot of them out in the country that can do the best of the best of the best. And so they come in and they say, I do everything at the cost of the work. There's no guaranteed maximum price. There's no lump sum. You pay for everything. And these are houses that are $20 million, $30 million, $40 million. And so, not that it doesn't affect the owner, but if they want that high-end quality, they say, sometimes, guys, if I have to redo it three times, I have to redo it three times just to get it the way you want it. So that's what sometimes you... And I have had these discussions with owners. I'm like, let's push back. They're like, I want this contractor. He's not budging, so you have to kind of move on. So that sometimes just happens in the career. So, question? Yeah, so government work, you're going to find they all have their own forms. That's the one area of work, that's a great question. There's one area of work where they're traditionally not going to use the AAA form. They're going to come to you and they're going to say, here's my contract, you sign it. And there's not a lot of room in there. Now, but the flip side is government contracts, there's a small little area where there may be statutes state by state that allow design build agreements. But government contracts are lowest reasonable bid, and they are all lump sum. Because when you have the big bidding, and it's because if you have open-ended deals, you're spending the public's money. And so, if we go back, God, at least 25 or 30 years ago, it was called the Silver Shovel? I'm blanking on it. But there was a big scandal in the city of Chicago where the aldermen and the different people, and even through McCormick Place, the people that ran McCormick Place, they were giving their projects to all their buddies. And they were making money hand over fist and everything else, so they came in and tightened that down. It's happened, not just Chicago, it happens in many cities. So government contracting is always closed bid, meaning nobody sees the bids until the day that they open, and the government must take the lowest reasonable and responsible bid. So reasonable and responsible give a little bit of flexibility where, like let's say it's a project where everybody bids at $10 million and one person comes in at $6.5 million, that one you don't think that's reasonable and responsible because everybody's in this bandwidth up here and you got somebody $4 million or $3 million less. But you must put a solid price in for a government contract and that's what you got to stick to. And what'll happen, and I've worked with a number of governmental agencies, what'll happen is the government will know that the bids are probably going to be, even though lump sum, probably going to be higher than had they did it like the private sector does. But the reason why they do that is because, let's take a $10 million project for the government. If you bid it privately and there was the government building it and there's a company building it, the same factory, the company's going to be able to bid it for $10 million. The government is going to bid it and it's going to get it for $11 million. You're like, why is there $1 million difference in the exact same project, exam, say drawings, blah, 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 blah. Well, in the private sector, change orders come and go and come and go and come and go. Government doesn't like to go back and do change orders. They don't like to do that. They happen. But they want to say, I want to be all in. So they would rather pay $11 million and not have to worry about it ever going over $11 million. They kind of build in their own GMP in that. But whereas the owner that says they can build it for $10 million, it may cost them $12 million. But the government's stuck at the $11 million. So there are different negotiations that come on. And that's why sometimes people are like, oh, government contracts are so expensive, you can make so much money on it. A lot of times it's because they don't want to have to go through all the paperwork of getting change orders later on. So, okay, that's a couple ones up here. A104, that's one, as I said, where they smush. The A104 on the front end of it has both business and the rules to monopoly all smushed together. And so the first half of the A104, it'll have a paragraph that says, you're going to do it lump sum, you put a check mark by that. The next paragraph will say, you can do it as cost plus with the GMP, you put a check mark by that. Or the next paragraph says, you're going to do it as a cost plus. So you get to pick and choose, check which one you're going to use. And then the back half of it takes that big giant 44-page document of the A201 and shrinks it down into about 25 pages. So it's an all-for-one document, and it's nice. It uses, and you'll see in a second, there's a sister agreement or a brother agreement, whatever you want to call it. On the architect side, it's a B104. And so often you use the B104 design agreement with the A104 construction agreement. Normally, they're it's called abbreviated form, smaller projects, something more manageable. I wouldn't use the 104 for a project of $5 million. I may use it for a $1 million project, but that's about the cap that I would use it at, just because if once the projects get more expensive, you need the teeth of the agreement to protect the owner and the architect. And then the last one, and there, like I said, there's hundreds of forms. The last one I'm going to mention up here is the A141, and that's a design-build agreement. So sometimes where the architect and the contractor are either jointly together, or the architect has their own construction side, or vice versa with the contractor. And so the owner just goes for one stop. I don't have a contractor agreement, I don't have an architect agreement, I have a design-build agreement, and use the A141. So, questions on that? All right. Okay, so on the B series, because those are all the A series, here's the B series that you're going to see. There's, I can't remember if there's a 102. I've never used a B102. So maybe there's not. But these are the standard forms you're going to use for the owner-architect agreement. The B101, as you can see, is that big giant block. And the great thing about the B101 is you can use it all the way from small up to big document, big project. So it is it's the workhorse of the owner-architect's agreement out of the AIA shop. I would say of the AIA documents that I negotiate, that's okay. Out of the AIA documents I negotiate, probably 90 to 95% are the B101. Occasionally I'll do a 103, occasionally I'll do a 104 and a 105. But if that's why I have you guys go through the lecture and everything else. By the way, if you want some donuts, there's some up there. So, then you have the 103. The 103, the way I like to describe it, is the 101 on steroids. Just a little bit of steroids. There's a few more provisions. And so, like, the 101 is, I don't know, it's like 16, 17 pages, whatever it is. It's probably two more pages longer. There's a few more paragraphs. There's a few more bells and whistles. There's very little difference between the 101 and the 103. But I do find clients, when they're doing projects that are 10, 20, 30 million, they want a little bit more oomph. So they'll say, let's do the 103. But you can use that 101 for that same project and do just fine as far as covering yourself as the architect, as well as the owner. The 105 is down on the bottom. That's a small project. So you're doing your backyard renovation. You're going to do, a small little project that's going to be, you know, anywhere between $100,000, $1 million maybe. You can use the 105. I think I've negotiated over the course of my career 3 105, so it's rarely used, but it's there. Very, very small. And then there's the 104, and the 104 is the one that parallels, as I said, the A104, and so they work really nicely together. They're designed. So if you're on a project where it's a $2 million home and the owner wants to do, and you guys talk about it, and you're going to use with the general contractor that it's going to be the A104, the compressed, abbreviated form that's got both sides plugged in, then the contract you'll enter into with them is the B104. So it's kind of, they parallel with each other. You won't use the A104 with the, I'm sorry, you won't use the B104 with an A101 and A201 because the consistencies of references to terms, the B104 refers to the A104, so they kind of marry together. So, questions on that? Good. Okay. Now, as I've been mentioning, and I said this throughout the semester, I keep giving examples like cost plus and design to build, or cost plus and GMP and everything else. So I'm going to talk about this a little bit more in detail, so we can, if there's any questions on it. So we talked about fixed price or lump sum or stipulated sum contract. That's the A101. And as I said, contractor carries the risk no matter what. I'm going to build it for you $1 million. No matter what it costs, contractor carries that risk. It's not a GMP that can change. It's not anything else. Contractor says $1 million, $1 million, $1 million. Now, there'll be change orders probably like in every project, but they carry that risk. The flip side is they get the benefit of any windfall. And so the difficulty for an owner, and that's why if you're going to do a lump sum project, you want to tell your owner to go out and get bids from 3 or 4 contractors to make sure the contractor you're working with is in the ballpark. Because that million-dollar project, they could come in, if you just go to one contractor and say, how much does it cost to build this project? He's going to say $1.4 million, and he's built in $400,000 of cushion, windfall, whatever you want to call it, into that lump sum, and you're always going to pay that $1.4 million. So that lump sum is what you pay no matter what. So there could be windfalls. That windfall also comes into play because the contractor doesn't need to show you any of the backup documents. They may be only spending $600,000, $700,000, putting in crappy plumbing, putting in bad whatever it might be. And so the contractor is making money on paying for cheap labor and cheap materials, plus they up-priced you there. So that's why multiple bids is prudent and reasonable to do. And it's even more advised, in my opinion, but I think you should always have multiple bids on every project, but certainly in a lump sum type fashion. That issue, though, is that the third point there, it can lead to adversarial relationships between owner and contractor. If you feel the contractor's not doing good work, and you come back and say, this is crap, you got to redo it, well, that's cutting into the contractor's profit because they don't get a cap. And so if you have to have it redone, then maybe the contractor's like, no, it's fine. Or maybe they'll cut corners here. And you as the owner or you as the architect advising, as the architect, your job will be harder because you've got to watch them a little tighter because you understand the industry. Your owner, most of the owners you're going to work with will be not construction industry savvy. So they're not going to see when things are done poorly. And then you have this problem where if you see something or you as the architect see something, then you have to tell the contractor it's bad. And that creates this adversarial because you really haven't seen behind the curtains. That's the thing about it. So I will. I don't believe that there are more, at least in my experience, I can't say, oh, most of my losses in construction have been under lump sum contracts versus GMP or cost plus. That I can't say because I've never really thought about it that way, but I can say that there's the projects have a different tension on lump sum projects, especially if the parties don't know each other. I do have some contractors that and owners that have worked together for years and they're fine. But if you have something where it's a brand new relationship, that can create this adversarial. The cost plus, that uses that same concept as the 102 and the 103, both that's the basis of it. And the fee, because it says cost plus a fee, the fee can be associated a number of different ways. It can be a percentage of the cost of the work. So if I pay my subcontractor $100, my fee to the owner is 10%, so I charge the owner $110. Or it's 5%, I charge them $105. So it could be a percentage. It could be a fixed sum. A contractor could say, like I had a project where the contractor said, I'm going to give you the exact cost of the work, materials and labor, and every month my fee, no matter what work I do that month, will be $8,000. So if I do $100 worth of work, you're still paying me $8,000. If I do $400,000 worth of work, you still pay me $8,000. So sometimes contractors will do that so they have an even cash flow. If you want to think about a construction project, it's going to ramp up very quickly. You're going to have costs on the front end from the general contractor, buying all the materials, all the labor and everything else. And then that curve will be a gradual slow. It's not going to be a true bell curve. It's going to be really up, and then it's going to slow down and then taper off. That's how the cash flow comes into the general contractor. The fee is the general contractor's money. They sometimes like to have it even across the board and not worrying about the ups and downs of the actual cost. That means the owner buries that high up and down curve, whereas the contractor just carries its fee straight across at that actual fixed monthly sum. And then there's some that I have that are, I've had this, and it's more rare, but you'll have an agreed-on formula. I get my $8,000 a month, but if the cost of the work for this month goes over X, then I need a percentage on top of that. You can mix and match it. I see that less than 5% of the time where the fee structures a little differently. So, as I talked about, the 102 can have that cap, that guaranteed maximum price that nobody goes over. The middle, the third bold there is if it's just the 103, it's difficult to control costs because it's an open-ended field. But that's why you want to go in and have that guaranteed maximum price. It's the best of both lump sum and cost plus. It's just kind of that middle road. And then I talked about the savings clause. The savings clause that I had suggested was 25%. You're going to see savings clause range from 10% to the contractor, 90% the owner keeps that savings between the GMP and the final price. The most I've ever seen it is 30% split, 30 to the contractor and 70 for the owner. And that's a negotiation that happens. Traditionally, it's 20, 80, or 25, 75. That's what you're going to see in most savings clauses. And then the change order, if you have a change order in the project, it's just going to be the cost of the work like anything else. You'll see the backup invoices and everything else. And the contractor will still get its fee. Now, what happens with a change order with a GMP, so let's go back. Change order is when I'm bidding the project for you, I know what all the drawings are, and the owner may make a change. I want to upgrade my countertops from linoleum to marble or granite. So that's a change to the design that costs more money. So who pays for that? Well, of course, the owner pays for that. So if the lump sum is $1 million and that change for the countertops is another $50,000, the lump sum gets a change order and the lump sum becomes $1,050,000. So the lump sum can change. And so when you end up finishing the project, the owner pays $1,050,000 because there has been a modification to what was originally bid. That happens in every other one of those. If it's a cost plus with no cap, you have change orders just to document that you wanted to have this type of marble or granite, but you're going to have to pay 100% anyway. There's no cap. So it doesn't really matter. Change orders are important just to document the project, but it doesn't change that the end price is still wide open on the cost plus agreement. For the GMP, this is where it gets a little more interesting. So if I have that $1.1 million GMP, and we have this $50,000 change order, the GMP goes to 1.15. That makes sense. It's a $50,000, so that cap goes up by $50,000. But if they still come in at $900,000, now we have, instead of a $200,000 gap, we have a $250,000 cap, and we do the shared saving on that. So the cost of the project always stays what the cost of the project is. The cap just raises, and it's to protect everybody. So sometimes the cap can help the contractor. Sometimes if the contractor price for the GM for that change order is not high enough, it'll hurt the contractor. But the GMP can raise. A lot of people get confused. They're like, why does the GMP go up? I thought it should stay even though we're changing something. It's because you are changing it. So that's how change orders work on the project for GMP versus lump sum. Any questions on that? Okay. There's one other kind of, we haven't talked about it a lot. I mentioned it a few times. Sometimes you'll see a project on unit prices. Unit prices as a project is, it's going to end up being, traditionally, it'll fall into the category of a cost plus. I don't normally see unit price contracts with a guaranteed maximum price. But how does the unit price work? Okay, you'll often see unit price work in road work, of unit price contracts in road work. For every X number of cubic yards of concrete that we're laying, it costs me X dollars. And in that cubic yard of concrete that we're laying will include a price of the rebar, the concrete, the labor, it'll all be baked into that unit price cost. For masonry jobs, especially if you're doing specialized high-end masonry, it may be by pieces of masonry that goes in. So when you buy the brick, however many bricks are, each brick is a unit, and that's going to have a price that will build in both the labor and the materials. Sometimes you'll see a mix. Sometimes you'll see a project where, let's say it's a milk-producing factory, so you have miles and miles and miles of piping that is moving all the liquid through everything else. It's not just the piping for the bathrooms, it's actually for the production of the facility. Sometimes what the contractor will say is, we're going to build this facility for you for $150 million, but all the piping, the stainless steel specifically, because we have to have stainless steel because it's going to be food grade and everything else, will be on a linear price, and that will be for materials only. Not materials and labor, it will be just materials. So X dollars per linear feet of stainless steel. And so you know that if we use 100 linear feet or 1,000 linear feet, you know what that unit price is. And the last thing you might see with the unit price contract is they'll have, like if you get, we did this with steel a lot. If you order from the steel manufacturers X number of tonnage, it's this unit price. If it goes more tonnage, volume discount, the unit price goes down. And so as you move projects to bigger, to bigger, bigger, that unit price can get a benefit to the owner. So that's a negotiation that comes in. But that's how a unit price works. And unit prices can stick into normal contracts or they can be standalone. Question?
So how do you
So the great question as to whether who makes the decision of doing the unit price is effectively what you're saying. And the answer is, one of my two favorite words, it depends. It may be a situation where the industry, and that's why I have like concrete and road work up there, the industry knows that it's going to be unit price, so that's just how the industry is driven. So neither the general contractor nor the owner is making a decision. The industry has been doing that for decades, so that's how you're going to see it in that. You may see it, though, in if somebody's doing a specialized home or a specialized project where they're going to say, you know, we don't know from the drawings. Well, let me back up. Let me do my first example. Let me give a second example. Like if it's a home, they're going to say, my subcontractor, the price of getting copper right now is difficult and everything else, so we're just going to book it because it's going up and down because of the market. We're going to book you into the unit price. In that instance, the owner kind of has to, if they want to use this contractor, has to kind of go with that. It normally will not be the bulk of the price of the project. It'll be just copper material or copper tube piping or whatever. So it'll be a smaller thing. It won't be a huge project wherever, because if it's a big project and all of its unit prices, that's an industry driven. So sometimes the general contractors say, my sub is going to be giving me his unit price, so we do. You're going to see that for like we did for steel studs. Steel studs, if you go back to COVID, when COVID was going on, construction was one of the few industries that keeps going because there's a lot of construction working outside. And then there was issues with China driving so much work and everything else. So the price of lumber went through the roof. And it turned out for the summer of 21, if I'm not mistaken, I can't remember if it was 20 as well. I don't think the prices had started really peaking out because of supply chain. But I know the summer of 21, steel studs were less expensive than wood. Your 2x4 was cheaper to buy steel. And because those were driven on unit prices because the factories just could keep making it. And so sometimes you'll have an element of that project that'll be unit prices, where all the rest will be your traditional cost of materials, cost of labor. The last area where, again, the owner's going to have less control over this is if you're on a fast-track project, where we'll talk about in a second, where you have, instead of traditional design, bid, build, you're going to have an overlapping, like a design-build project or wherever, where they're still designing while they're building. Sometimes the drawings that come out from the plumber, you know, the mechanical engineer, for whether it's the HVAC or the plumbing or whatever, they need what's called one-line drawings, so it's not detailed. And you may not know how many feet you're going to need when you get into the project because the drawings aren't 100% developed. Everybody's going really fast. And so for those, when you have one lines, whether it's electrical, mechanical, or plumbing, those one lines may drive that you have to use unit prices. It's this circular vent here, this could be potentially priced out at a linear feet cost as opposed to a lump sum cost or actual cost of materials. So again, it may be the project that's driving it, and maybe the contractor because of its stubs, or maybe an industry.
So, in places that they build like normal buildings are built in, or the economy of the country is just everything, all types of prices, even cake, out of stores,
yeah.
They go up and down, meaning that unit prices for a contract is more common.
That's a good question, and I honestly don't know the answer. That if we're in an economy of flux, whether unit prices are more common or not, if I would venture to say, I would say it's not necessarily more common, because the problem with the unit price, it works both ways. just like a lump. The unit price is kind of like a lump sum, but it's based on per foot or per cubic yard, or it's a volume, so it's, you can have one piece. With a lump, and becomes a lump sum. For every linear foot of this copper, that's the price. And so everybody knows that. And in that instance, the contractor takes the risk if it goes higher, and the owner can benefit if the price is lower. So the owner and the contractor both have risks and rewards. And so if I'm a contractor, and again, I don't know the answer to your question. It's a great question, but I've never really looked at it from that angle. If I'm a contractor and I'm in a fluctuating market, I'm going to drive that to the owner, you pay the actual cost, so I'm not at risk, because it could be really high, it could be really low, and you don't know if that unit price is going to be sufficient. Again, this is just pure speculation. My suspicion is that unit prices are going to be more common. Well, the economy and different materials always go up and down and up and down. You'll watch to see how the markets change and the futures market and everything else. When it's in a smaller band, when it's not as crazy, my guess is unit prices are going to be more common there because there's less risk for either side. When it's up and down, that's when you want to make sure, especially the contractor, you don't want to get yourself over your skis. But again, I don't know. So, okay. All right, competitive bidding. Now, if you remember when we were looking at the B101, Article 3.5 of the owner-architect agreement, had the architect assist with competitive bidding. There's negotiated bid and there's lowest responsible bid. I talked a little briefly about it when we were talking about government contracts. So we'll talk about how those things work. So you have traditional and fast-track methods for competitive bidding. As I had said, if it's a government project, they are required for public projects. And that's so that the contractors and the people in the government can't have their side room deals and pay politics and spend the taxpayers' money. The reason why they're statutorily required to be the lowest reasonable and responsible bidder is to protect the taxpayers. So, and I've actually been saying responsible and reasonable. It's also responsive. Responsive means it's also reasonable that you're responding to what's in the RFP. Sometimes you'll get bids that come back. I actually had one of these projects. It was a big, big bid. I don't remember all the details, but it was 8 or 10 pages of all the things that they had to do for this project. And when the bid came back, one of the contractors missed an entire page. So their bid was significantly lower, but they—I don't know if they didn't print it out or what happened. So the elements that were on that one page were not in their bid. So they were deemed as non-responsive, and so their bid was thrown out immediately. So it has to be reasonable, responsible, and responsive. And if they're not, if they don't respond to everything in it, the bid doesn't come in. The second is what's called, that you're going to see in competitive bidding, is called best value. Best value is rarely used in public projects, but if there's a statute within that governmental entity that allows to have design build projects as opposed to design bid build, where the contractor and the architect are separate, for those projects, then you can use what's called the best value. So when you open up the bid, that allows the owner to say, well, I've got a $10 million bid here, and I got an $11 million bid here. In a traditional competitive bidding, you would always have to take the $10 million if it's responsive and reasonable. But in a best value, you can take the $11 because you recognize that their trades are better at what they do, that their logistic plan makes more sense, that the value that this entity is bringing, because it's a design build, the architect's design is better, it works better for all those things, that brings a better value to the governmental agency. So, but again, like, I did a lot of work for McCormick Place and Navy Pier, and that's all government loan, and we had to work through the statutes that they had passed strictly for Navy Pier and McCormick Place to make sure that we were properly bidding the best value projects for the projects that I did for them. So, and then sometimes, in a very, very rare instance, and I had the pleasure of doing one of these, and it was actually a really nice position to be when I represented the contractor, was sole source. Now, with a sole source project, this is on the government side. I'll kind of spin back on private side in a second. Sole source project, you have to be designated as the only bidder in the area, the geographical area, the reasonable thing, whatever, to be able to do the work that's at issue. And then the government doesn't have to go through any of the bidding projects. They can just award it to this company for the dollars that have been negotiated. They're like, that sounds like it's just waiting for corruption because they can cut whatever deals they want and blah, blah, blah. But sometimes that's why there's very strong checks and balances to prove that they are a sole source. I had this for about a dozen years. I represented, it was this really cool company. They started in the oil industry, oil and gas, down out of Texas. And they did a lot of wildcatting and digging oil wells for everything down there. But as they moved along, one of the things they got specialized in is all the offshore rigging. They would have these divers that would go down and fix the piping systems that were underneath these rigs. And not that what they were drilling down, but all the piping system underwater. And so they had to figure out, if you want to think about it, so if I got an oil rig and I got a, and I'm on land and I got a pipeline that I'm taking my crew and I'm moving it to, you know, the refinery. Well, whether it's above ground or underground, I can dig it and I can shut it off and I can fix it and everything else. But when you're underwater, you can't do that as well. And so you have to develop what's called hot tapping. And hot tapping allows this company, it's really cool, it allowed this to come in and literally build right next to, there's a pipe, and it's running crude oil or water or whatever it's running through, and build a pipe right next to it, and they kind of bring like the connection end so they're parallel, and then within, and this, some things are huge, within a 20-hour period or 15-hour period, they will connect them all. They'll shut one off and shut one on, and it'll go on. It's called hot tapping, so you don't stop the flow of the water or whatever it was. And we were able to bid a project in New York City. They had a water pumping station and cleaning water, and it supplied, I want to say, 50% of the drinking water on Manhattan. And it was underneath the Hudson River, and there was another plant that they had that was in a building in, near that. There was, you had to go seven stories down, and there was a huge underground system and everything else. We were the only company in the Western Hemisphere that could do it. They're out of this Texas. And there's one company that does it over in Japan. There was another one in Australia, but the only one in the Western Hemisphere that could do it. So that was like the most fun negotiating, because I'm negotiating with the state of New York and the city of New York, which you would think would be like, they can do whatever they want. They're New York, you know? And I was like, guys, this is the way it's going to be. That was really fun being on that side. That'll occasionally happen for sole source. They also did the hot tapping from, you know, if you look out in Lake Michigan, those two big water, there's those, like 5 miles out, there's those two big kind of structures out there. They pump water to seven suburban areas, seven, they come, at least the north one does. And we had the hot tap, and the size of that pipe for water was 120 inches, so it was huge. A huge, giant pipe that they hot tapped and put in. So, and they have to do all the engineering and the forces, because you can imagine you flow that water and it has to turn the corner and turn the corner. They have to have all these blocking because it's going this way and then it has to turn and turn. So all the physics. So it was the 24-hour period when they tap, everybody kind of holds their breath. I mean, they've been doing it for years and years, but you're never really sure. So, and if you shut it down, there's seven suburbs that won't have any water. So it's a high risk, but that's why they're the only ones that do it. So, just general competitive bidding, obviously, is to get the lowest price, and you want to have it so when you open up the bids, it's impartial to the best extent. When you're going to be doing this best value, or you know where it's a negotiated bid where it's not the lowest reasonable and responsive bid, you can shortlist too. Let's say you go out, and we do this a lot on the private side. Private side will do lowest reasonable responsible, but more often they're going to do the best value. It helps the shareholders and everybody else understand it. But what you want to do, and this is what I advise my clients, so you go out to bid to build, like this weekend's Churchill Downs. You got anybody follow the Kentucky Derby? Did you guys know the Kentucky Derby's tomorrow night? So, Kentucky Derby's tomorrow night. I just was listening as I was sitting in traffic today. I didn't know it either. One of the three, so there's the Triple Crown. There's the Belmont, there's the Triple, the Kentucky Derby, the Belmont, and the Preakness. I represented the Belmont for about a year and a half, and at one point in time, they were going to redo the entire clubhouse and put in a new mudder track, which is the track where all the horses run when it's muddy, and then who was the governor at the time? But the money was either going to go to the new hockey rink that was there, or to Churchill Downs, or to Belmont. It went to the hockey rink, so now they're redoing Belmont now. But when you do that, we went out to bid for the actually in this case it was the architect and then there was another for the owner's rep. We got back like 8 bids. And so what we did is I said, let's pare this down to 2 or 3. And we shortlisted. And then we can start using them one against the other. We can take, oh, this is this cool design element I like here. Can you do it without giving the copyright away from it, or however you want to deal with that? And so, oh, they're going to do this for this price. Can you do it for that price? And it helps to balance the scale. So it's like a competitive bid, but you actually then can use them off of each other. Create like a, I mean, even for Bella, we used to kid about it. It's like a horse race. I mean, who's going to win the race to get the best project? But private businesses, you guys, if you're ever an RFP, we did that for Haribo. We had 6 contractors. We shortlisted it to 2. We awarded to 1. So that's a very common thing. And as an architect, if you are engaged under the B101 under the Article 3.5, you'll be part of the negotiations for that. So, questions? Okay, competitive bidding also traditional and fast track. So the traditional project, the typical project is when you're doing this competitive, you're going to have an invitation to bidders. So you send out, sometimes it's you have a closed, you send it out to 5 contractors, please bid on this. Sometimes it's published. Like if it's a public job, they have to be published in the newspaper and on the website and everybody else. So anybody that wants to bid on it, they can. I did a bunch of stuff in Canada. They have even these more really restrictive rules how they do it. But generally, it's some type of invitation that goes out and says, hey, we're doing this project. We want to see you guys to bid. Then the bids will be submitted, the proposals, and they'll be sealed. And the RFP will have a specific time. All bids must be in by Thursday, May 5th at 5 p.m. Anything that comes in at 5:01 will be rejected, and there's somebody there stamping it, or it comes in nowadays, obviously, electronically. But it used to be back in the early days, the covered wagon days of my career, where I would make sure that there was somebody at the owner's office with a stamp, a time stamp, that would be stamping those envelopes that came in. And I will say this, there were a couple times where I'm getting calls, they knew I was a lawyer, like, we're in a cab, and I'm like, I can't do anything about it, it's a public job, you got to get it in on time. If it's a private job, you can give some little flexibility, but the public job, somebody's going to come back and say, you can't cut corners. So, then there's an opening of the bids and the presentation. That's going to be in a room like this. A lot of times you're going to have the desk, the dais, where it's going to have the people from the, especially in the public job, they're going to have people up here and they're literally going to open up and read it. Then everybody in the audience is going to see it and you're going to win. You're going to hear if you won the award right there. That's less so in the private entities, the private sector. They're all going to come in. I'm going to be on the team if I'm involved in it, and we're going to get everything in by Thursday at 5 p.m. and we'll have a meeting at 10 a.m. on Friday, and we'll either be doing it by Zoom or we'll do it in a room and we'll open it up and we'll start going through and talking about it. And then comes the evaluation process, and this is the most important thing on competitive bid. If you're doing a government job, has to be reasonable and responsive. So the first thing you do on the government job is make sure that all 9 pages were responded to. Like I said, this one project, they missed a page. We don't know why. We tossed it. So you go through the responsive first. Check, 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 check. It's responsive. Now you go through and are their numbers reasonable, and how you see whether they're reasonable is you compare them to other ones because you've opened them all at the same time. And for then, on the government side, if it's reasonable and responsive, the government doesn't have any more choices than they must take the lowest. Unless it's best value, then you can get into the more detailed evaluation. On the evaluation for a best value type project, a negotiated bid where you can have that horse race and limit it down, I do what's called a KT analysis. I am blanking on what the initials are. I want to say it's like Kenzo Tang, but I'm not 100% on that, but it's a process where you put this giant grid and you take the bid and you break it up into different the management team, the price, the logistic plans, their background and experience, a bunch of stuff, and that's like all the columns on the left side, and then the top side is contractor 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and then you break them. You rank them 1 to 10, 1 to 5, whatever the numbers you want to do, and then you score. And everything, and some scores have a weighted average. Sometimes each section is equal. There's all different ways to do that, but that's the evaluation process. I will have been brought in on the team solely to rate and review the contract markups. Because one thing that's going to come into me, it's going to, for that bid will have the price, our floor plan, our logistic plans of how we're going to do the construction, our team, and all the bells and whistles. And there's going to be a markup of the contract that went out with the RFP as well. And they're going to have their changes. So I will rank that. But you'll have specialty people, the people that know how the facility is going to operate. The people that run the factory, they're going to be running and reviewing that part. The people that know management teams, they're going to be doing that. So the team that is evaluating is very important. And so sometimes you as the architect will be asked to help the owner put together that evaluation team. And that's the most critical. I had a client once who got brought in. They did a ton of procurement. We weren't brought in simply to do their construction procurement. It was to revamp their entire procurement process, because that's one of my specialty areas is RFPs and procurement and this process of getting the best value for your client. And so we were brought in, and I said, let me see. They had a huge procurement department, and they were buying tons of materials and food and everything else, because they were in the entertainment industry, plus we were building a facility for them. And I said, let me see how you guys do your procurement. And the first thing they showed us was their ranking system. And it was red, yellow, green, and blue. And I'm like, I tell them green and blue. So what's red worth? They're like, it's worth red. I'm like, well, what if it's like, I go, is red good or bad? And they're like, oh, bad. It's really bad. I'm like, well, does that mean if it's on a scale of 1 to 10, is it a 1 or is it a 2 or is it a 3? Well, it's red. I'm like, so when I get to this contractor, is this a blue-green or a green-blue? Like, I couldn't believe they were ranking this thing by colors. So traditionally, you're going to see numbers. And if you ever find a client that uses colors, tell them to switch them to numbers. And then you can do an average. You can take a 4 and a 5 and get 4.5, as opposed to, that would probably be a yellow-green, I think. I don't know. Whatever it was. Chartreuse, there you go. Like, what are we doing here? And we revamped their entire procurement department, and it was a really good learning lesson for them, and it was they don't need me as much anymore, which is, you know, for me, which is great because I helped the client out. But anyway, and then there's a notification of the award. Sometimes, as I said, it's going to be in a room where everybody sees where they're open. Here we show it; it's all public. We're not doing anything behind closed doors. And then ultimately, there's a contract to negotiate, and you sign that agreement. So that's your process. Questions on that? Okay, what happens if there's an error? Sometimes, like I said, you miss a whole page. They were tossed out because it was non-responsive. But sometimes there's other stuff, and how do we handle that in a bid? So if there's a clerical or arithmetic error, it may be withdrawn but not modified. If you, as the bidder, do the wrong math, that's your problem. You can pull the bid back, but you can't say, oh, I really meant it to be this. So where that comes into play and the reason why, it seems pretty harsh, just a math error. Why do you toss that? Well, what you don't want to have is a contractor bidding and coming in and winning the project that's the $10 million project, and they bid 8.9. It's close to $10 million. But it's not quite, so it's not so far out of the range that we're thinking that they completely screwed up. And then you award them because they got 8.9. You haven't gone through the detailed analysis of every single thing because the lot that goes into a $10 million bid. And then it turns out that they switched the numbers and it should have been 9.8. And they turned out to be third best as opposed to the best. They're going to be like, oops, we made a mistake, I'm sorry, and everything else. I, as the government, don't know that. Maybe they put in 8.9 on purpose, and they were going to flip it later, and contractors do that. So you can't put the onus on the government to make an assessment of whether it's an honest mistake or not. An arithmetic mistake is your mistake. Now, why would a contractor withdraw? Well, if they realize that they can only do it for $9.8 million and their bid says $8.9 million, they're going to lose $1 million. So they're going to say, I don't want the award, I'm withdrawing my bid. Yes, I screwed up in the math, but I don't want to take $1 million hit for that. Award it to the person that came in at 9.3. Don't award it to me because it's not my bid. So you can get tossed, or you can withdraw, but you can't fix your error. Same with a judgment error, where they come in and say, oh, I really thought you meant that you were going to have, you know, this many rooms as opposed to that many rooms, and I bid on this many rooms. That one, you can't withdraw. So if the contractor thought there was going to be four bathrooms and it was five, and they bid, and the bid clearly says four bathrooms, but the drawings clearly say five bathrooms, and they are awarded the lowest as lowest reasonable and responsive bid, they still have to suck that up. That's not a math error, that's a judgment error, and they, contractor, must do the project, and they must build five bathrooms. Well, I thought you said, Mike, earlier on, you can't make force anybody in labor to do anything, and that's true. And so what often happens in governmental projects is in order to bid, you have to put a bid bond down, $100,000, $200,000. I've seen bid bonds up to $1 million for a big project. So when they withdraw, they lose that money, and that comes straight out of the pocket. So there's a little bit of protection from someone that says, well, screw it, I'm just not going to do it. What, you can't make me do it? Well, then I'm going to keep your bid bond. So there's some protections for the owner on that. And then the exception here is what's called the snap-up rule. A snap-up rule allows you to withdraw your bid where the owner should have known that there was such a difference. So you made this error in judgment, and it was a $10 million project, and it was like 9.9 and 10.1 and 9.5. Those are three bids, and then you're at 6.9. Well, and it's only because of the error of judgment. It's not an arithmetic error, but whatever it might be. The owner's being like, ooh, we're taking the 6.9 because I don't want to pay $10 million. We're taking this. Well, that would put the contractor in dire straits. And so that's the snap-up, where the government's taking advantage of something that it really should know. I mean, even if it was like $8 million and you have three up at 10 and there's eight, I mean, that's a 20% difference. Is there a specific percentage that falls into whether the snap-up rule is triggered or not? No. It's a judgment error. Sometimes that's what the lawsuits are about. But that's to protect where there was really an issue. And the argument, we didn't for the sky where they missed a page. We treated it as judgment error, or we treated it as a snap-up because we could have done it, but we told them, you're going to have to withdraw this because you weren't responsive. We could have just taken it and said, well, you didn't include that page, that's your problem, that's a judgment error. You had all the pages, we know, we sent it to you, we have the transmission and everything else. We didn't force that because they could have come back and said, that's a snap-up rule. So we just said, you're not responsive and you're out. So sometimes the owner can treat it one way or the other without putting the contractor, because sometimes, like, if you get kicked out of a bid, the next bid when you're bidding, when you get, like, one of the questions that comes on an RFP, especially for government projects, is, have you ever been rejected in another bid? And so you have to disclose whether you've been tossed because of an error or whatever. So sometimes you, as a benefit to the contractor, you allow it to say, well, this would have been a snap up and you're not responsive, so, you know, not to put their reputation at risk. Okay, different types of contracting. So that's all in the competitive bidding and the bidding negotiation. That's at 3.5 in the B101 that you guys will come up to, or will be on the exam. There's a lot more information on that when you get into the nitty-gritty, but for purposes of the exam, that's all you need to know. Contracting methods, different ones. So the traditional that we've seen here, I've got this, now I finally got some little graphics and everything else. Your traditional is the triangle. There's our triangle at the top, and then we have your consultants, as I was talking earlier, the consultants on the design side, and the subcontractors on the contractor side. Then there is somebody that's just going to be supplying materials. Sometimes, like, there's a lot of contractors that may do one type of work. They'll be like, we're a general contractor, but we specialize in drywall, so we'll do all your drywall labor, but we get the drywall from a vendor. Or we are a general contractor and we do concrete. So a lot of times a general contractor will start it as a small subcontractor in the beginning part of the company's history, and then as they grow and grow, they become a general contractor, but they hold on to their one type of work. And so they still have to buy materials. So the materials will come from a vendor, and the subcontractors are going to provide materials and labor. So that's your traditional method as far as how they structure the legal contract structure goes. What are the advantages? it's the most common that you're going to see, owner-contractor triangle with the consultants and the subcontractors. And what happens is, as far as the way the structure is, because you have the architect and the contractor separate, you traditionally have the plans mostly finished before the contractor bids, so there's less risk and less unknown. It's design, then bid, then build. It's a linear process. The architect remains independent, then the contractor not combined. And this method will work with lump sum, cost plus, or GMP. It will work with all three different types. So, disadvantage, the contractor is not engaged in the design process. So what happens is the contractor comes in and sees, like, what the hell is this? How do you build this? This is crazy. And then it starts some adversary relationships. There also could be some benefits if the contractor's there earlier. On the construction management side, they can give ideas and inputs of how to build stuff. So that's one thing that would be, that could create an advantage if the contractor's there early, but then the traditional linear design, bid, build, contractor's not there. Slower time from beginning to end because of the linear fashion. I talked about the adversary relationship between the contractor and the owner, contractor and the architect. The architect saying your work is bad. The contractor saying your drawings are bad. You know, they kind of are initially enemies because there is no contractual tie between them. Price competition says reduce profits and render some projects unattainable. That can just depend on when you're at a position, like, are there enough contractors available when you're bidding it? And are they, because of the way the designs, are you going to get the best bids coming out from that? So the concept of claim contractors is a risk that where contractors, and there's some that have these reputations, where they will bid, so let's go to this $10 million issue, this $10 million project, five contractors, three of them bid, you know, anywhere between 9.5 and 10.2, so they're in that $700,000 range. Then there's somebody that's way at the bottom, like 8.1, so they're completely off the map. You're not going to go with them. And then there's this contractor that comes in at like 8.9. So you had maybe 9.0, 9.0, but you had the 9.5 to 10.2. Everybody's closer to 10 million, and your architect was always working with a budget of 10 million, and the architect's estimate is like, it's going to be about 9.8 or something like that. So you got three of them, three of the five that are up where the architect says it's going to be. You got one that's an outlier, they're out. And you have this one that's just a little bit lower, they're the three, and you're like, wow, they're at nine. So not too far off. I'm going to go with them because they have the best price and blah, blah, blah. And then it turns out that they submit a change order and a change order and a change order and a change order and a change order. And they make their money up after they have been awarded the project. And so that $9 million project becomes a $12 million project because the contractor is really good at every single time that they can get an extra buck, they're going to be papering and papering and papering and papering. And I've had projects that have had hundreds and hundreds of change orders by claims contractors. And at some point in time, you're like, fight, 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 fight. And you give a lot of, sometimes you negotiate them out because it's just, and so that's a risk you run with the claims contractors, and you want to do your homework, and you as the architect will know the industry. I mean, you're not going to know right when you start working, but I guarantee you, when you guys get out there and you start working with your senior people at the companies you work with, you will start to learn who the ones that you got to be a little more careful than others on that work. And truth in bidding is just, you know, to make sure if we're doing this traditional method, if it's lump sum, are they really seeing behind the curtains? So, questions? Yes. Truth in bidding? So the disadvantage of the truth in bidding is when you do this linear design, bid, build, the bids come in and you may not be able to see the true numbers because they're just going to be high level. And if this is going to be more in the lump sum situation, how much will the contractor be building into that? Let's say the contractor comes in at 9.8, but they can build it for 8.5. How much of that 9.8 that they bid is their own internal fluff? Will there be, and that's like, it's going to be with a lump sum because in the lump sum, you can't see behind the curtains. If it's a cost plus or a GMP, you'll eventually see all those numbers so you can keep them under control. The truth in bidding is more about if you're doing the traditional with a lump sum project. Does that help? Okay. Next method. Delivery as a method where this one says is the prime. Developer is a prime as opposed to a general contractor. So here we have an owner, and an owner goes to a developer and says, I want to invest. And I want to invest in this and to build a high rise. But I don't do this, but I have money, so I'm going to go to you and you're going to develop this project for me. They're known for putting up high rises. They're known for putting up subdivisions or anything else. So this entity, the developer, will be in the middle. Sometimes you may also have an owner, like one of my really favorite clients is, they are the owner and they have created within their own company a development arm. So it's the same people, but the owner is a private equity investor. He's a financial guy. And his son is now running the development company that they've created, a separate company, and they are developing hotels and retail and parking structures and everything else. And so it's a separate, but the money's coming from the financial guy, way up top. And so it's a way to separate legally the money from the people that are managing it. And then from there, it works the same way. It works as far as the traditional triangle. And so the entity that's going to sign that B101 and the AIA A102 or whatever it's going to be will be the developer, but there will be an agreement between the developer and the owner as to how the cash flows. So, and sometimes it's this single purpose LLC. Remember we talked about the LLCs as a structure. I have a lot of guys that do... One of my partners, he represents this company that's a big developer, and for every single one of their projects, they create a single purpose LLC. So if it's at the corner of Michigan and Indiana and they're putting up a condo building, it'll be like the Michigan Indiana LLC. Literally, they'll call it by the street corners. Or the 401 North Huron LLC, and that'll be the address of it. So it's not anything creative, but for each individual project, they create an LLC that becomes the developer for the project slash owner, and the main company sits on top and funds and finances it. So. Yeah.
So in that agreement, for the contract, the developer is acting as an owner. Is that different than from the contract language of the
That's a great. That's a great question. And so, traditionally, the relationship between the developer and owner will not necessarily be an agency relationship. What will happen is when I create a limited liability corporation, I'm going to have members of that LLC, and one of the members will be this top box that says owner. So let's say the financial is Mike Hanahan Financial Inc., and I'm worth $1 billion. I'm not, but I have all the money. We're going to create the 401 North Huron LLC, and the members are going to be my construction team and my 16-year-old son Liam, because I want to build generational wealth for him. But Mike Hanahan Financial Inc. is going to be a member of that, but I am not the, and so that will become the owner. So it's not acting as an agent. It is acting all of its own, and because I'm a member, I will be helping them making decisions. I'm not a manager, I'm a member. The manager will be my son Liam, because he's the one that I'm building generational wealth with, and the other construction people will be members or the investors or whatever. So for the purposes of the contracts, it's truly an owner, and they are not acting technically and legally as an agent of the entity on top, because I'm in there already. So, but what happens is if something goes south of the building, the lawsuit's going to go against 401 North Huron LLC and can never get to Mike Hanahan Financial. Even though I'm a member, I get distributions, but it's really only operating as that owner. So it's not an agency traditionally. I mean, you can have agency relationships, but normally it sits as itself. Okay? Question? So the question is there a pushback on single-purpose LLCs? I would say no, because single-purpose LLCs are used not just in construction, they're used all over for businesses everywhere else. And if you go back to the advent of when LLCs first started coming into vogue, if you remember the lecture back, it's the whole tax issue and the liability. You know, you want to be able to have the protection of a corporation where you can't sue the shareholders and the officers and everything as individuals. You only can sue the company because the company is considered an individual. That's a protection of liability of people's personal assets. But you had that double tax that you had with the corporation. So they created this entity called LLCs. That is such a strong driver for development of business and moving things forward that the concept, and it's, Delaware was one of the first states that really put this into play. And so for years and years, most of it, not years and years, but for a while, people were registering their LLCs in Delaware because it had the most favorable laws and they were the first kind of into the game. Now every state in the country has them. So the concept of an LLC and a single purpose will not get pushed back. But as we get to construction, what happens with typically in a single purpose LLC is that LLC will continue to operate whatever that business is. But if you think about construction, so I create 401 North Huron LLC and I finish the project and I sell it to the condo association and I'm out. And I defund my 401 North Huron LLC. There's no more money in it. It's just a thing that sits on the books with the state of Illinois as a registered company. And then when something goes wrong with the building, there's nothing to sue for. How do we get to the money, the owner, if that single-purpose LLC is a shell of a company? And there's a series of cases started with what's called Cypress Creek here in Illinois that have now come back. There was a big push for years to try to figure out how do we protect ourselves from that shell company. And there are the laws have started to change to say, under certain circumstances, you can do a leapfrog around the developer box to get to the owner to protect that very same instance. But in the business world, generally LLCs are going to continue to operate that company. It's just when you pull out, like you do with construction, like, I'm done. So they've tried to protect it in the construction law and the courts to protect those people that are the owners buying it. Not the general contractor, the architect, it's the people that are buying the buildings. So, okay. Anything else on that? All right. Fast track. So I keep talking about fast track, so let me show you how fast track works. So we have, under the traditional model, design, bid, build. Now there is a little bit of overlap you'll see where the design is still kind of finishing up because you're never 100% finished with design, so you're always going to be tweaking everything else, but it's enough. I'm going to go out to bid at like 90% or 95% because I really need to get this roll and I want to know if we're within. Architect, you keep giving me the estimate, you tell me your estimates under your budget, are we really there? Let's go out and bid. And we come back like you blew the budget, so let's redesign. So that's why there's an overlap. And on the flip side, there's an overlap between the bidding and the construction because once you get the bid, and if you can make that award, you may be doing horse racing, but like what I've done with especially design build projects is I've had the two horse races start to do engineering. And I'll pay them both at the same time to do some of their design build stuff and see how that's working. So when we finally award the project, so we spend a little bit of money to a company that's never going to do it, but we've moved things advanced along. So that's your traditional model where there can be some overlap, but it's much more linear. And if you can see at the screen, the design starts on both of them start at about the same time, but it ends much longer. If you look at this as a calendar from left to right, the design bid build is going to take longer than the fast track. Fast track, much more overlapping. You're going to go out and design, and the design portions can be longer because you're going to be designing package by package. The first package that's going to go out is going to be foundation. The second package is steel. And so what will happen is the design process will take more time because you have to finalize each package as you move along. But when you get that package to your bid for the contractor or the subcontractor, you can get the construction started earlier. What you'll traditionally see in the fast track is you're going to see sometimes drawings will go out as early as 30% complete for the entire project, up to about 60. Construction will almost always happen 60 to 70% of the drawings being completed. You're not going to wait to 80, 90% on a fast track project. So you'll go out at 30. You should have, these are big projects, you should have sophisticated contractors, and they're going to be able to bid because they've built 100 hotels, they've built a bunch of this, whatever it is going to be being built. And they're going to say, based on the 30% drawings that I'm seeing, or maybe 40%, I can give you a GMP. You're not going to have a lump sum. You're going to get a GMP that says it's going to be $175 million to build this hotel. And you're going to bid it against three other contractors, and you award them the $175 million. And the contract will say, you give me the $175 million at 30%. At 60%, we're going to give you another chance to tighten your bid, sharpen your pencils, and we'll start releasing packages and you can start construction. So 60%, that $175 million will never be higher. The contract will say it can never go higher than that $175 million. But if you sharpen your pencils, maybe it'll come down to $172, $174, $169, or whatever it is. And then you'll have maybe even a second rebid at like 85%. That allows you to get the contractor on board, because the contractor's there while design's going. There can be value engineering. There's communication going on between contractor and owner, contractor and architect. And you can get the prices better and the project better, and it's finished faster. So this is a much more collaborative process. It takes more sophisticated designers and contractors, but it's much more beneficial for the owner. If we go back 30 years, 30-some years since I've been in this industry, I would say the fast-track model was 20, 25%. It's well over 50 now. Maybe 60% of the projects I do are fast-track, because the contractors know how to do it. The designers know how to do it. It helps everybody. And, I mean, if you think about it also, like for a contractor, they can get six projects done in a year instead of five, because they're moving faster themselves. So, anything on that? Any questions? Good. Okay. Next method. This is called a multi-prime contract model. Multi-prime is something I rarely ever recommend to an owner. Multi-prime says, I'm an owner. I know what I'm doing. I'm just going to hire everybody myself. I'm not going to use a general contractor, because I don't want to pay that additional 10% markup. I've done this before. I can do it again. A multi-prime owner that I would say should do it, or probably does do it, McDonald's. How many times can they make the restaurant over and over and over and over and over and over and over? But if you come to somebody and they're going to build a factory, don't ever do a multi-prime. The owners, even if they built a couple factories, because it's not in the state, or, you know, there's so much that goes into it. But as you can see in this this layout here, the owner contracts with everybody directly. So the owner's carrying all the risk, not just the monetary risk, but the construction risk, the liability of injuries. They are the general contractor while they're trying to run their business, whatever that might be. So, I have had owners that have come to me and said, we really, really, really want to do this, and I'm like, you really, really, really don't. And occasionally, they don't listen to me and they do multi-prime. And I will say, I've had some owners that have done multi-prime that have done fine. And I've had some multi-prime owners that I just didn't say I told you so. They did the best they could, but it cost them a lot more. That's just a general overview of what my opinions are, but if you can look at it, contractor has all the contracts. There may be legal reasons why they do this. They may be themselves general contractor licensing. There may be reasons why they want to do this, although rarely have my clients convince me that that's a good legal reason, but as I said, they're not often able to successfully manage. That's not what they do. I mean, like I said, McDonald's builds. But like, well, I'll give you an example of one company that they did your traditional owner contractor subcontractor. Then they turned to multi-prime. This is during my tenure of when I represented them. And then went back to traditional because of the headaches. So there was a health club way back. This is going back into they started, I think, in the 60s or 70s, called Valley Total Fitness. I don't know if you guys have heard of Valley Total Fitness. So it was like a health club, like going to, I don't know, like Orange Theory or just any sports, you know, like where they have all the weights and everything. It was just a sports complex. So they were the very first in the industry to start doing that. And actually, if you're driving toward O'Hare, one of those buildings has Bally's on it. And they're associated with actually even the Bally's, that's the casino out in Vegas. So Bally Puddle Fitness, they started expanding. They started in the Midwest, and they started growing. And they were then building health clubs all over the country because the health club craze was going crazy in the 80s. And they brought in to their company, they hired a general contractor, and he was licensed. They had two or three of them that were licensed general contractors. They were licensed in multiple states. And they hired people that had done construction management, and they were the people in the business. But they, out of the box, because they hadn't done enough of these health clubs and they were different, you know, places in different cities and stuff, they started doing general contracting. And so they would hire a general contractor, and that would be managed by the development group within Bally Total Fitness. And I helped them write those contracts. And then they had built in, like, I think 37 or 38 states, and they decided, okay, we can do this. We've been doing it all a lot. And we did a couple of, not a lot, we did for about a year and a half, we did Owners of Prime. It was a debacle. Even though these guys were super good at what they do, they were really good people, and they were very earnest, it just was too much. And maybe it was because of the scale and the speed that they were building so many things. And we had, you know, I think we had at one time a dozen Owner Prime contracts out there. And it just was a lot. So they went back to the same model as before, of the traditional general contract. Anyway, it can happen. It can save money for the owner. It also can go wrong. So, but that's a model that's not uncommon. Okay, construction manager, that's the next model. Construction manager contracting model. So here, there's two types. There's construction manager as an agent, and then the next one I'll show you is called a construction manager as a constructor. So construction manager as an agent, if you take a look at how these blocks are connected, so in every one of these, by the way, when you're going back in the exam, there may be some questions that I'll ask about this. Anytime you see a solid line between one or two, a box to a next box, that means there's a contract. Just like when I always had the triangle, there's solid lines between owner and contractor, owner and architect, and a dotted line or no line between them. If you see here, there is no line from the construction manager as an agent between anybody but it and the owner. So, like, well, what do they do with respect to the general, to all these subcontractors and this trade contractor? What are they doing? Well, they may be in a prime model, an owner is a prime, which is this one set up to. They may be doing the behind-the-scenes stuff that a general contractor does. So what they'll do is they'll say, I will run all the books. I will walk the project site, and I will approve the application for payment. I will communicate with the architect. I will do all of the stuff that a general contractor does, the management of the project, but I won't carry the contracts because I'm not contracting with them. So you contract with them on your paper. You save some money there. I'm going to charge you for my fee. And I'm effectively what I sometimes refer to as an owner's representative. This model, whether you do the traditional design, bid, build, or you have a fast track or all these other stuff, any project where I represent an owner, where the project can afford it, I guess is the best way to say it. Is that a million? Is that 3 million? Is it 5 million? But anytime it's 5 million or more, I strongly recommend to the owner to at least get this green box on their side. Because this guy with the green box, or the woman in the green box, not only are they going to be looking over the contractor's shoulders and the subcontractor's shoulders to make sure the billing's proper, that they're meeting schedule, that the work has been done correctly, they're going to be looking over the architect's shoulder, make sure the designs are correct, make sure that the architect is hitting schedules. That construction manager as an agent isn't going to be correcting the design. It isn't going to be fixing the work. It can't tell any of those people to change what they're doing. But the construction manager is sophisticated and knows the industry and can relay it to the owner so the owner can communicate that. Or sometimes in my contracts, I put the construction manager as an agent, and truly here they're acting as an agent to speak on behalf of the owner. So this is a true agency relationship, but the construction manager has no ties to anyone but the owner. Questions on that? I'll just give you one example. Like, I had a client that had never built, we were building a facility in an area they'd never built before. They had a decent architect, they had a good contractor. We were in the process of doing, we had shortlisted in the two contractors that I'd been representing for about a year and a half, because I did all the architectural agreements and I prepared the construction agreement, and we were getting down to the awarding. And I had been, this is a $300 million facility. And I'm like, do you have an owner's rep? Do you have an owner's rep? And they're like, no, we don't have it. We can do this because they built in other areas. And I'm like, okay, but you've never built this here. Like, we're fine. And I kept saying, I'm like, how about if we just bring somebody in, because we were the part of the RFP of the horse race where we were down to two entities. I said, why don't we do this? Let's bring in an owner's rep. I've got a list. Oh, we'll get a list. Okay, because they didn't want to like think I'm bringing my buddies in or whatever. I'm like, so they like, we'll go out and get one. I go, let's bring them in for the last 6 weeks of this RFP process and see if they can assist in helping those two contractors sharpen their pencils. And this, and I told them, I've been telling them for years, I go, this is going to cost you about $1 million a year, but this is $300 million facility, guys. I can guarantee you that no matter what you end up paying this owner's rep, they will have saved you that much money in the cost of this project. And in the 6 weeks that they were there and having these contractors sharpen the pencils, both contractors dropped, one contractor dropped their price by 10, the other one dropped it by like 14, and we awarded it to that contractor. I'm like, we had them here 6 weeks, they saved you $14 million. They have already paid for their work. And so they were like, oh yeah. So I'm strongly telling clients that they need to have an owner's rep, because they will almost always save you more money than you are spending on a project. And it's nothing against the architects, because the architects can do some of those skills as well. But a lot of times, and I applaud the architects for that, they want to design and not get into the financial management of the project. They're not financial managers generally. So you guys do, you stay in your lane, design and advise and assist the owner. Owner's rep looks over the shoulder of the owner for both sides, and then the contractor builds theirs. So, okay, this one here is the second one. This is the construction manager at risk, or sometimes the construction manager as a constructor. So here we have, now you're seeing, this looks like the same triangle. You got the owner and you got the architect on one side, and you have this construction manager at risk on the other side. What's the difference between that and if it's just a contractor in that purple box? The difference is timing, and only timing. The construction manager at risk, or construction manager as a constructor, will come on board during the design process. It'll be more in the fast track phase. And that will allow the construction manager to do pre-construction work, to advise the owner, to work with the architect on design. They are still separate companies. They are not aligned and joined, but they become more collaborative. And so at some point in time when the drawings are done, even though they're still called a construction manager, they're really just then a general contractor. There's no difference after the construction starts. They manage their side of the triangle like a normal general contractor does, and the architect manages their side. But there is a collaboration, and the agreements are written in the construction manager agreement that there is this interface between architect and contractor on design ideas. There's no contractual relationship with them still. As you can tell, that purple and blue box don't have any dots or lines between them. But there's a communication that's built into the agreements as they're written. This is probably one of the more successful models that you're going to see out there. And what I recommend is this model with that green box on the side that the owner still has somebody looking over the shoulder. So you call it a CM at risk, with a CM as an agent or an owner's rep, and then the architect on the other side. And I would say in my big projects, 75% of them work in this model, and 50% of the times I can convince the owners to get that owner's rep. Because they always don't put it on their budget. They're like, well, that's another $1 million that my budget didn't have. I'm like, okay, but it'll save you money. So, all right, any questions on that? So, here we have your spectrum, your risk spectrum. And we didn't talk about the advisory CM, but I will tell you, like, an advisory CM is somebody that's going to come to you. The architect can even be an advisory CM, but they're going to come to you, like, really in the beginning when the owner's sitting there going, God, you know, like I want to build a factory. Where do I want to build it? And advisory CM, they say, you know, they may know things like real estate. They may know things about taxes. They may know areas. They may know land. So they don't have any real engagement in the project. You could have an advisory CM that then becomes an agency CM or becomes a CM at risk, but there's very low risk of the advisory CM When you get the agency CM, there's a little moderate, because if I'm the guy, I'm the entity that's managing schedule, and the schedule gets screwed up, there can be some liability to that construction manager as an agent. If I'm processing payment applications and I have errors in the payment processes, fraud or otherwise, as a CM, as an agent, because I'm responsible for that risk, or because I'm an agent to the owner and I overstep and the owner gets sued, I have some risk. So it's a moderate risk, but it's much less so. And then your CM at risk, like I said, it's the highest risk. It's just like a general contractor, it's just a better model because they're in earlier. Flag this page because I guarantee there'll be a question on this one. So, okay. Anything on that? Okay. Design build. So we're coming kind of the end here. Design build is going to have your traditional, very basic design build. You got an owner, you got a design builder. The design builder can be made up of contractor-led design build, so the contractor brings an architect onto its staff. Or it could be architect design build, or a contractor, they bring a contractor on staff. But it's one entity, it's a company that's a design build entity, that's all they do. And so it's a one-stop shop. I come to you and I say, I'm going to build a factory, I got a $10 million budget, design it, build it, go. There's no bidding, there's no negotiations of bid, there's no checking of prices, you have this relationship and you go. That's what a design build, very, very basic and simple. Design build started coming into vogue in the 70s, got some real good legs in the 80s. You see it a lot more common now. It happens quite a bit. There are some architects that don't want to take the risk because they're not used to contracting, but there are other architects that recognize that if you take the risk, you're going to get paid more. So you have more design-led design builders now than you had 10 years ago. So, okay. There are various types of how these work. So you have an integrated company. That's where it's one company, but both the architect and the contractor work for the same company. So it's the same entity. As I said, contractor is a prime, AE is a sub. So sometimes you may have the contractor. So the contractor signs the agreement, and they, as a design builder, and they hire the architect as a sub. So it's still in a vertical line, but the owner only contracts with the design build entity. Could be flip side, the owner's the architect's the prime and the contractor's the sub. AE is a prime with multiple trades, and I think I have a slide of that coming up if I'm not mistaken, where you have the architect and then you have all these different subcontractors and consultants below. But it's always that first step is owner, design builder, that first step is always a single purpose. Design builder prime AE contractor with each sub, so what you may have is the owner, design build box, and then there are two entities down here, so they've created, for purposes of this project, you have an architect that's a standalone architect, you have a contractor that's a standalone contractor, but for purposes of the project, they've come together, whether it's as a joint venture or as a single purpose LLC, to be that design builder, but they still run their businesses downstream like they would do in a traditional triangle, but for purposes of that bid. And you'll see this a lot in the industrial complexes. So a lot of the work that I did in the middle phase of my career was we did clean, I think I talked a little bit about it, we did energy clean coal, where we would build these process plants that would take up a particular set of coal. And so the contractor has to build this giant $600 million facility, but there's a technology that's built in, the engineering, the technology that siphons and takes the particulates out of the coal, so when it goes into the smokestack, it's 98% just water vapor. So what will happen is you'll have the technology provider, the engineer, and the contractor, and for that bid of that project, they're two huge companies, Siemens and Turner Construction, so these two giant construction and a giant technology provider, for the project they make joint together and bid as a joint venture. And so that's the contract is with the joint venture, it's not with Siemens, it's not with Turner, it's with both as a single joint venture. So sometimes you'll see that structure with those relationships in the design build. So here's the way the slides will look at it. So you have the owner and the design builder with the two different design affiliates. This is where either they're a joint venture or they created a single purpose LLC. But as far as the owner is concerned, one-stop shop. So that's how one of those models that I just talked about. Second one is the multi-integrated, where you have a joint venture design affiliate, where the on the design side, they've entered into agreements with the architectural, the mechanical, the electrical, and the structural engineer on the one side, so they have a whole bunch of people under that joint venture, and then the contractor has brought in their own subs and everything else, so that's a collection of all, and they then contract with the owner, and it's so that you have this joint venture between the two, and then there's already a joint venture downstream. The owner still looks at it, because if you look at the same time, the way the slide is written, this is truly actually just a single design build with these joint ventures. They should be together, but it graphically is the best way I could represent it, because each one has their own joint venture relationship. What are the advantages of design build? As we saw, that linear thing, it's speed of project delivery. It's a single party responsibility, that one-stop shop. You don't have to look to multiple parties. You do not get that adversarial relationship back and forth because it's the same entity. I will say cost certainty becomes earlier, and there's questions about that, what that means by earlier with better results. But if you think about it, if I go to you and you're a joint venture or your design build entity, and I say I have a $10 million budget, and we come to a price sooner than later, the architect isn't going to be over-designing that the contractor has to figure out, and the contractor is going to have to keep in with the architect once. And so those two entities working together, as opposed to competitively, can create better price certainty at an earlier phase of the project. So that helps the owner. And that's why I said, if you go back in the 70s, there was maybe 25% of the projects, maybe 70s, 80s, 25% of the projects were design-build. Now they're, or fast track, and now they're much more common in the current industry. Better communication, less litigation because you're not having people pointing fingers at each other. Greater control of the information. You know, if I'm an architect and I deliver to a contractor, here's my steel package. They're going to open it up and they'll be like, what is this, what is this, whatever, and they have to go back and forth. But when I give the steel package to the contractor and it's my partner at the company, I can give it to them. They can look at it and they can say, well, maybe we should change this and modify that, and they give it back to me. And so this collaboration control of the drawings before we even have to go out for pricing, that's much more advantageous to everyone, the owner, the architect, or the contractor. Negotiated pricing, you're going to get probably less of the competitive negotiated pricing coming out from that. But because the architect and contractor are working together, when the pricing comes back, you can say to the team, hey, I didn't think that these trusses were going to be this expensive. Can you come up with a better design solution? So it's a negotiation of both the design solution and the constructionist solution, which creates a better pricing model. So, and then the last one, as I said, they're not adverse because they're in the same company. That's some advantages. Disadvantages. You do not have the architect looking over the shoulder of the contractor, you know, because they're on the same team. So if the architect cuts corners, or the architect, you know, isn't doing a great job, or the flip side, the contractor arm of that company is not building it right, nobody's looking over either party's shoulders. So there's some risk in that, and that's why you want to do your homework when you go retain a design builder. Pricing can be some suspects. So as I said, you get better price certainty, but maybe how do you know if the contractor and the architect, this design build entity, isn't building in more extra fluff because you're not getting that competitive negotiation process. So it's like anything else, there's trust that you have to have in the industry, there's homework that you do to make sure you bring in the right entity, but that can happen in design build projects. And that could bring more risk. It could be more risk onto the design build entity. It could be more risk on the contract or the owner, just because of the uncertainty when the pricing's coming in. And then, as I said, who's back checking? So, as architects, you're going to be more on obviously the design build side of that if you guys get involved in those projects. So you won't be the one. But when I go to an owner again, if there's a project of significant size and they're doing design build or another thing that's similar called EPC, engineering, procurement, and construction, that's when I say bring in your construction manager as an agent. Bring that green box in to be the back checker, because straight owner, design builder, there is no back check. So bring that third entity in there to help the owner out. And what's the differences in the design phases services? So these are kind of advantages too. I'll just give you a description of what it is. I just talked about one. There's this thing called looping feedback. So when I give the steel package to my contractor side, maybe it's only at 30 or 40% done. Here's what we're thinking about. Here's how we're going to do the steel package. They can say, well, modify this, modify that. Then they flip it back. So it goes in this loop. And maybe there's two or three times where the drawings are going between from package to package. Steel, concrete, plumbing, electrical. Those packages go back and forth and they loop and they become circular to allow you to come the most economical construction and efficient designs as possible. So that's a very differently than your traditional design bid build. There's no looping, there's no feedback. Construction manager at risk, there's some looping, but not nearly as much as design build. Informal communication and defensive dealing. You don't have to overdraw. If I do a line drawing and I'm working with my contractor who knows what my line drawings are meaning, where it's just one line for like where the ductwork goes, we know this ductwork, this thing has probably 12 to 16 inches, it carries space. So in this drawing, you would normally draw it with two lines because it has space. But if you're doing design build, I can do a single line knowing that there's a duct that's going to be going through here. Later on, between my HVAC guy and my HVAC subcontractor, she's on the other side, they're going to work it out to find the size and shape of the duct. But you don't need to do that when the architect's drawing it as two lines. Defensive detailing. You don't have to overdraft. You don't have to put over specifications because you're having more communication. So that's a very different animal than design bid build, where the architect may put more than necessary so the contractor doesn't have as many RFIs and there can't be this competition. Greater incentive to explore alternative designs. That's that looping thing. They're going to be giving a different ideas, collaboration between the people that build it every day and the people that design it every day. And like I said here, this last thing, the MEP and the fire protection is only schematic. They'll be just line drawings, and they'll be fast and quick, one-line drawings. Riser stacks will just be little simple stacks that they'll show, and the contractors all understand that. Different design phases. So greater than usual pricing constraints and price inputs, that's another thing that you'll see, because what you want to do in design build is you want to make sure that the pricing constraints, how they're coming back with pricing, because there's no bidding, you have to have better constraints on how they do that. So that's going to be communicated between the owner and the design builder. Out of sequence provisions and design details to meet the contractor's need. Sometimes they don't need the plumbing right away, but that may be the package that normally goes out. Or they may say, I need plumbing because we have a shortage on copper right now. So that may have been traditionally in your traditional design bid build or even a fast track. If we weren't together, that may be the third or fourth package you're giving me. But I want to get it because we see the price of copper going up. So can you give me your plumbing package second? You're going to do foundations, then plumbing, then steel, as opposed to foundations, steel, rough carpentry, and then plumbing. You're going to do it earlier to allow the pricing to be more beneficial to the owner and the contractor. So you can get out of phase sequence and you can tailor how the designs are being created between the architect and the contractor on both parties' needs. So that's a really good benefit to there, that collaboration again. I think that's it, isn't it? That's it. Okay. I'll turn this off. Oh, no, I'll turn it on because there's some people that are here as far as questions on the exam. So the exam will be the same model. It's going to be multiple guests and true and false. I probably said this last time. My wife hates it when I say multiple guests. She's like, they're not guessing. That's what we call multiple guests. So multiple choice and true and false. I think the last exam was, 40 questions? I think this will be 30 to 35. There'll be, I believe, I got to go back and look, it'll be two or three extra credit questions. So again, I think we had one or two on the first one, didn't we? On the midterm? Did we have extra credit? One, okay. So it'll be two or three extra credit ones. if you have no guess and you have no idea, circle something. If it's the end of the time period here and you haven't had time to read it and you're panicking, circle something. You may get it right, you know. And if you don't have it, it doesn't affect your grade, because I graded on the first, I think it's 32 or 33 we're at right now, and then there's a 3, 2 or 3 on top of that. So it doesn't affect you and your grade, and it only can help you. And I do that all at the end when I do all the curve and stuff. There are some people that I know I've answered some people on their bumps already for the midterm. Somebody submitted a paper, and I don't know who is in the room, if you were the one that did it. I haven't read it yet, but I will read it, and I promise to get it. But if there are other people that were going to be submitting a paper, I think I've only gotten one. So if you are going to and you haven't submitted for the midterm, I will still take it. I think I have to have my grades in. It's like the 12th or 13th, the Monday or Tuesday after you guys' class is closed. I will take anything you want to submit to me until the very last day. Try not to get it to me at like 5, because I still got to submit the grades. I have to get the grades in by 5 o'clock, I think. But I will take that, and I will get the, I will promise, and I know I'm trying to get the exam moved to Thursday. I will promise I will get your grades out that night. So if you want to write a paper, you can. The paper will be the same type of concept that it's for the final. You can submit 2 if you want to, and it'll be on just the second half of the semester. What I will do is to help, because it's a truncated. I will say, of my 13 or 14 years doing this, I think I've only gotten like 3 or 4 papers after the final, just because you guys have so much to do, and I understand. But if you really want to do it, I'm not discouraging you. Please do it if you want to. What I will do is, when I send out the grades, I will have 3 topics. That will be your topic sentence. That way we don't have to go back and forth, and they'll say, write a paper. I mean, if you want to do something different than my 3 topics, that's fine. I don't care. So I'll give you 3 topics so you don't have to waste your time on it if you want, and you can just write something, same thing, 3 or 4 pages, double space, submit it to me before. That'll give you a week or half a week, because if we're going to move it to Thursday, it'll give you some time between cocktailing and seeing your friends and going through the ceremonies and stuff, that you can write one if you want to. Question? I haven't heard yet. So right now, the email went around, and it's scheduled for Tuesday from 10 to 1 in this room. And Tom said, hey, we need to have it moved because a third of us have our presentations on like at 2 o'clock on Tuesday, and the other 2/3 have it sometime on Wednesday. And I immediately sent to Rodrigo, can we move it to Thursday? So well, let me check right now, actually, see if there's got an email back. Pardon me? I don't know. I'm going to check my phone right now. Give me a second. I just asked for it to be moved to Thursday. So let me see if he did. Hold on. And if not, I'm going to swing by and talk to him about it. But let's see here. Okay, so there's one. This room is not available. She's going to check for 2480. Okay. Yeah, so here's what they say. This is what I got the answer, and so I'm still referring to the people, but I'll send this out an email. They think they can have it either B500 or B510. Is that your studio area? Okay, they said they're nearby design room. So it's either B510 or... So B510 seems better option because it's more enclosed and possible for sound. And it would be from 10 to 1 on Thursday. So, that's what they're... And I'll go back and... it's not confirmed, but that's what they're saying. So it would be Thursday from 10 to 1 in B510. No. I will say... I say no because most of you guys, I think everybody was within the time frame. Maybe there's one person on the midterm that was right at the end, and I gave some extra time. It didn't really matter. The final is shorter by 5 or 6 questions, and most people get it done. I mean, some people get it done in 1.5 hours, some people go 2 hours, but I would think you should be able to get it done. So if you come in late, but let me just put it this way, and I don't want to say this to everybody, but if you come in 1/2 hour late, unless they kick us out, I will stay till 1:30 for you. I will give you your 3 hours. This is about you guys, not about me. I've been saying this all semester. I don't want to put you in a bad position. Obviously, it's a big deal for your mom to fly in.
I'm just wondering, like, it takes a while for her to get
through. I totally understand. I get that. So if you walk in late, I will make sure that I'm around to help you out and keep you there, okay? So, I mean, I already told Rodrigo we can't do it on Friday because one of your guys is going out of, they already have a plane to go home. So that's why it's Thursday. So right now, I will double confirm before I leave, but Thursday, B510 from 10 to 1 or from whenever you arrive till 3 hours later. Or you finish, whatever comes first. Okay? All right. Any questions, anything? As I said, you don't even have to rank me. Just if you guys have questions or suggestions, please. That's the only thing I really ask for in the reviews is tell me what I could do better or what have you. But if you want to say next thing, that's fine too. Anyway. All right. Thanks, guys. I will see you next Thursday. Yes?
So when was the last possible date to be? Did you say after graduation?